Hello, and welcome to the Net Zero Investor podcast. I'm Atharva Deshmukh, the head of research here at Net Zero Investor. Today's episode, well, it's about a book. And it's about a book that is on the NZI summer reading list, a list that was put together by the editorial team here at Net Zero Investor. If you haven't already, I invite you to go have a look at that list. Maybe you'll find your next favorite book on there. But today we're talking about A Field Guide to Responsible Investing, Asset Management in the Age of Polycrises. It's a book written by Amy O'Brien. Amy is the Global Head of Responsible Investing at Nuveen, an asset management company. Amy, welcome to the episode. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. So to kick off our conversation, I thought we could begin with a brief introduction. Could you tell us a bit more about your role at Nuveen and maybe a bit more about Nuveen's responsible investment goals?
Sure. So I am the global head of responsible investing at Nuveen, which is the asset manager arm of TIAA. I arrived at TIAA actually about 20 years ago, and I was the first hire in asset management fully dedicated to the field of building out the responsible investing practice. And so now fast forward 20 years later, I'm leading a team of more than 30 professionals who are working on all types of activity under our responsible investing umbrella and really focused on integrating environmental, social, and governance factors across our $1.3 trillion portfolio, which is very broadly diversified, public and private markets.
So let's start at the beginning of your journey, because this book actually brings out your journey in many ways. So let's go back to, as you write in the book, that bright June day in 1996 and your internship at the Council on Economic Priorities. What was that day like for you? And what did responsible investing mean to you back then?
Well, looking back, a couple things come to mind about the first day. I had just actually moved to New York City, so that was my first solo trip on the subway to get to work. So that was also something that stands out. But really, now that I look back, I probably didn't realize it at the time. I think many of us don't when we're having those experiences. It was truly transformational, right? So I was finishing up a graduate degree. That was my first introduction, truly, to the world of corporate social responsibility research. So this was long before the term ESG. ESG was even coined, but it was really an organization that was dedicated to those consumers and largely mission-driven investors who had begun to use CSR information to make purchasing and investment decisions. And so that's something that, you know, hindsight's 2020 and you look back. The other things that come to mind were really the vivid and painstaking work, manual work of trying to gather all the research we needed from very sparse sources at the time, often outdated and based on, you know, what likely would be viewed as very simple metrics today.
Right. So this book, like most books, has a lot to do with its context. And you mentioned in the book how you started writing this book a couple of years ago. What motivated you to write this book? Why do you think this was a story that needed to be told?
Yeah, I started writing the book, I think, during the start of a particularly challenging period for our industry. We were definitely starting a couple of years ago to face, you know, more significant questions, more visible backlash against ESG, while simultaneously dealing with what I call polycrises in the book. You know, those multiple interconnected global challenges hitting simultaneously, including climate change, social inequality, and geopolitical instability. But what I was really beginning to get concerned about was that what I was doing on a daily basis, what my very talented team was doing on a daily basis, you know, really wasn't matching the sound bites and the questions coming out from the key stakeholders and critics on both sides. And so that motivation really got down to seeing this sort of persistent misconceptions about our work. And, you know, I thought that it was important to articulate a first person through line that would encompass all the various facets of responsible investing, you know, many of which are often presented as standalones. And lastly, you know, just, you know, talking to friends and family over my 30-year career, I realized we need to make this field more accessible versus something that I would call as an insider baseball problem in our field with a lot of us, you know, continuing to talk in practitioner speak. So we need to make this field more understandable to the average end investor.
Right. And I think it's worth spending some time on that term you use in the book, polycrises. Could you explain a bit more about what you mean by polycrises? It seemed to be part of the reason why you write this book.
Yeah, I mean, it's simple definition, right? Multiple interconnected crises occurring simultaneously at unprecedented speed, right? It sounds like something we're all experiencing every day. But, you know, when it comes to that term and how it intersects with responsible investing, that term captures something I believe is essential about our current moment that traditional investment approaches still struggle to address, especially when not thinking a bit longer term. So we're not dealing right now with isolated challenges, but with multiple interconnected crises that compound and amplify each other unpredictably. So take climate change, for example. It's not just an environmental issue, but a risk multiplier affecting supply chains, creating geopolitical tensions, driving migration, and triggering, in some cases, financial instability. So I think when you look at, you know, those themes and how it intersects with our space, we thought that was a really appropriate concept to really distill throughout the book.
And I wanted to focus on one particular chapter. That was chapter 4, aptly titled A Tour of Asset Classes. And it's about, as you write in the book, quote, a stock, a bond, a building, and a farm, which I thought was really interesting. Let's start with stocks. You write about how in the early days of responsible investing, the focus was mostly on this particular asset class. Can you tell us what the benefit of listed equity is in the sense, and why did those early days focus here and not elsewhere?
Well, I think this chapter is really important because, you know, unpacking how investments work is really something that, you know, I'm finding is also a pretty big need, you know, for more broad education. But when we think about listed equity, why did we focus the early days and the benefits? It really was the asset class that was most widely held, you know, by investors. I mean, maybe stating the obvious. And it was where the early toolkit evolved. Right. So with corporate disclosure, we had some information, right, about the what we would now call ESG performance of companies. We knew, what do they make? Where were they operated? Where, you know, around the world. And so some of those early information fit into those early days of exclusions or faith-based, you know, exclusions or controversial business involvement, which again got back to the early days of mission-based and, you know, faith-based investors who really wanted to align their portfolio. So you had the information that you could, you know, at least take some action on the portfolio through that asset class. And then secondly, and, you know, this is also in the book, is really the importance of the proxy vote and the shareholder rights and corporate engagement. And, you know, it's important to note that the U.S. market, we started seeing social and environmental issues appear on proxy ballots as early as the 1960s and early 70s. So there's this really long history of that part of the responsible investing toolkit. And so that's where a lot, at least in the United States, a lot of the investor was attention was focused. And so I think that that's important to remember that a lot of those early shareholder proposals, as they got into the 90s and early 2000s, were about getting companies to disclose more ESG data. So those early years with shareholders filing proposals around GRI reports, SASB reports, that really got the whole ecosystem going that had, you know, lasting impacts for other asset classes to come.
And in terms of stock selection or company analysis, you mentioned in the book how some of the metrics that responsible investment practitioners use push investors to think beyond financial metrics, and that's a good thing. And you give this example of a utility company in the book to illustrate what your thinking is like. Could you explain that? How is responsible investment-based stock selection ultimately just what you call prudent, thoughtful investing?
Yeah, that's really the example. We chose that carefully because we believe it best illustrates that when you expand your analytical framework to include all material factors affecting long-term value creation, that's really where we see the power of this more holistic approach to, you know, analysis. So when we analyze a utility company today, you know, traditional financial metrics would tell you about current performance, but ESG factors, in our view, reveal future viability. So say, for example, a utility with significant coal exposure faces stranded asset risks as renewable costs decline. Regulatory pressure as states here in the U.S. adopt clean energy standards and companies and countries around the world. And the financial facing challenges as investors increasingly avoid those high carbon emissions. And so we aren't making political statements, say, if a utility has coal exposure. And I want to be clear about that. We're analyzing how energy transition economics would affect their long-term cash flows and competitive positioning. And we've seen when companies accelerate their coal phase-out timeline after, say, engaging with us in our stewardship work, it's reflected the business reality about operational costs and capital efficiency. So we really have to think about that. And we chose that example carefully again, because you know there is a lot of focus on fossil fuels and the role of some of those stranded assets. But really, this comprehensive approach is all about considering regulatory trends, technology cost curves, physical climate risk to infrastructure, and stakeholder expectations from customers, communities, and investors. And so we think this kind of analysis should appeal to everyone, not just those investors who are seeking positive environmental outcomes in their portfolio. It's about that resilience part.
And moving on now to the discussion about bonds. You write about how a similar story plays out here. Non-financial responsible investment criteria contribute to a more holistic understanding of the security itself. So looking at the broader market today for green bonds and SLBs as well, these are obviously two very different financing structures. One is UOP linked, one is KPI driven. Of the two, would you say there is a particular part of the market where responsible investment led analysis has made more progress?
Yeah, I think, you know, first of all, I want to mention that a lot of innovation is happening in the fixed income space right now. So there's new areas that are emerging that require more analysis to really understand that risk return outcome profile. And some of these different types of securities may be more appropriate for one type of portfolio, say an impact portfolio, over another type of portfolio, say an ESG or sustainability leaders portfolio. So both really represent important evolution in sustainable finance. When it comes to green bonds, as you said, you know, their use of proceeds focus, they do provide more concrete frameworks for credit analysis. When we evaluate green bond financing for energy efficiency or renewable projects, we can assess specific investments, measure the definable outcomes, and incorporate improvements directly into, say, a cash flow projections and risk assessments. And we also have a long history of things like the green bond principles providing established standards for making analysis more systematic and comparable. So that field, you know, the first green bond, you know, that's another one of those older, more established, you know, areas. And I think we're finding that those are very, very much aligned to when we have an impact portfolio for clients. So the sustainability linked bonds present a bit more of a complex analytical challenges, right? As you mentioned, the KPI linked structure requires credit analysts to assess sustainability target materiality, ambition levels, and achievement likelihood across diverse corporate contexts. So, you know, these, we still believe these are innovative, but some of the, you know, the lack of the standardized frameworks are making consistent analysis a bit more difficult. So again, you know, both structures we believe are contributing to the evolution of what we think is, has a lot, there's a lot of potential in fixed income. And the real progress here, though, is that responsible investment-based credit analysis is becoming standard practice. And it's not just limited to things that are quote unquote labeled.
Moving on to real estate, what I found really interesting is you mentioned this particular program called CPACE, which you say has helped attract institutional investors, including Nuveen, into the energy efficiency opportunity. Could you briefly explain what that program is and why are institutional investors drawn to it?
Yeah, apologies here for another acronym, but CPACE does stand for Commercial Property Assessed Clean Energy. And it represents an innovation and an area that Nuveen has really leaned into for financing that's opened significant institutional capital deployment opportunities for energy efficiency investments while addressing that traditional market barriers. And so what happens with CPACE? The mechanism allows commercial property owners to finance energy efficiency improvements, renewable energy installations, and qualify clean energy measures through special assessments on property tax bills. So financing attaches to the property, not to the building owner, solving the incentive problem there is when paying for those improvements might not capture long-term energy savings benefits. And so for institutional investors like us, like many of our clients, these are compelling characteristics that are achieved in addition to the, you know, energy efficiency benefits. So we, you know, provides predictable long-term cash flows, typically, you know, 15 to 25 years, which match institutional investment horizons. And so there's a lot more technical things I could go into there, but it makes it very attractive for, you know, directly contributing to building performance improvements that we're targeting and many of our clients are targeting. We can't solve, you know, the green building problem by just building all new green buildings, right? We have to actually deal with the current building stock and investing in the energy efficiencies. And so we believe that the scale here, the policy support that it's behind it, the scale opportunity is really significant, and it really demonstrates how well-structured policy can mobilize private capital for climate solutions. So we'll certainly be focusing on more, and we're just finding a lot of investor interest in it because, again, of really matching the long-term investment benefits.
And lastly, the farm or natural capital. In the book, you give this example of Nuveen's vineyard investments in California and how physical risk is a part of the analysis there. So how has Nuveen incorporated physical risk into investment decisions in, quote unquote, the farm or natural capital?
Yeah, I think this is a really important topic because it provides such a concrete example of how we are incorporating, frankly, across all of our real assets portfolios. But its physical risk assessment has become fundamental to our real assets, in particular our natural capital, as you mentioned. And this approach has evolved dramatically from basic agriculture analysis over the years to this sophisticated climate adaptation strategies. This is possible because some of the data evolution and revolution that's happened here. But the vineyard example, you know, it really illustrates that when evaluating assets today, we have to conduct comprehensive climate risk analysis, examining, say, wildfire exposure, where we all read about what's going on, drought probability, extreme heat waves, and changing precipitation patterns. So these aren't theory or future state; they're current realities that that are affecting operations, insurance costs, long-term asset values, and frankly, helping us make decisions about where we are going to purchase land in the future. So, you know, we are using multiple data sources for this, for physical climate risk assessment, partnering with organizations like Moody's, Verisk Maplecroft, Munich Re, to really model these climate scenarios and assess both acute risks like wildfires and chronic risks like shifting growing conditions, because we have nearly 3 million acres in multiple countries. And so this is probably one of the biggest success stories, I think, in terms of responsible investing across, you know, moving from, say, listed equities years ago to real assets, become very much more sophisticated. And today, it goes beyond, frankly, even physical risk integration, extending to assessments to adaptation and resilience, and frankly, having us and taking us in directions of forming, say, new partnerships with organizations like the Nature Conservancy on biodiversity measurement, and really getting us into even more holistic thinking about this asset class. And so I think it's the perfect example why we wanted to talk about the farm in the book as well.
So let's pivot now to the way you respond to the anti-ESG backlash in the book. One of the points you raise is that for asset managers, there seems to be this chilling effect. In other words, the rise of greenhushing. Are we in an era of greenhushing, and is silence a viable antidote to political noise?
Yeah, this is a topic that, you know, I think a lot about. But even a couple of years ago, what were we all focused on? We were actually focused more on greenwashing, right? There was a concern, frankly, that too much information that wasn't credible and really wasn't helpful for making investment decisions was out in the marketplace. And so, when I think about the current environment we're in, I do believe that precision are good things when it comes to transparency from asset managers. You know, what are we doing? What can we credibly take credit for? You know, when it comes to how we're describing our process, how we're disclosing characteristics of portfolios. So certainly something that we're watching closely. I mean, we remain committed to a number of the global frameworks that has a part of those commitments, disclosure requirements. And so that is something that we think is critical. Frankly, our clients are demanding that information from us. And so while there may be some focus on that now, something we're watching closely, and we would be very concerned if this led to a huge decrease in corporate hushing, if you will. But again, we also have, you know, a situation in the US where this is more of an issue versus parts of the world where it's actually required, you know, regulatory requirements have gotten to the point. So we are, I don't know if you know what the right word is for this period, but we're certainly watching this closely. And our approach has been to refocus conversations on the financial materiality and investment performance, leading with these investment cases rather than what you know we might call the value case. So we think that it is a long trend to that transparency is here to stay, regardless of what political climate. And we don't think that the clients themselves will accept the fact that companies are not putting out the information that they're looking to choose their managers on.
So in the interest of time, I think we should try and wrap up. So I'm going to come to the last segment of our podcast, which is what I like to call the CIO elevator pitch. So this is where we ask our guests to summarize their perspective on the topic of the day. So in this case, Amy, imagine you enter an elevator with the CIO of a large pension fund, and you have until the end of that elevator ride to convince the CIO to add your book to their reading lists. So what do you say?
Well, first of all, how many stories are we going up? Is it? No, this is probably the worst question you can ask anyone in our field. Again, I think, you know, practitioners have a hard time really wrapping, but I have put some thought into this, right? So I think what I would say is that, you know, you need this book because you're managing assets in a world that's fundamentally changing. And the investment managers who understand and take credible action on these shifts will have significant competitive advantages. If I had time, if we were going up a few more floors, you know, I would also emphasize that the book provides, you know, practical evidence-based guidance, not theory. And you will get a better understanding of the responsible investing toolkit, how it works, get ahead of changes that are impacting the entire portfolio, all asset classes. And then the end, your clients expect you to understand these risks and opportunities. So read it this weekend. Your portfolio's future depends on it.
Wow, that has to be one of the better elevator pitches we've had on this show. But with that, we come to the end of this episode. Thank you, Amy, for joining us and sharing your insights on your book. I definitely enjoyed reading that. It's on our summer reading list. I invite our listeners to also go pick up a copy. But yeah, thank you very much and have a nice day.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.